Hello, I'm Toby Davey, and welcome to this extended version of my podcast interview with Mike Ingham, former BBC football correspondent, who has recently released an audiobook version of his autobiography, After Extra Time and Penalties, Memories of a BBC Football Correspondent. From the age of seven, Mike had always had a burning ambition to work at the BBC. He got his first break working at BBC Radio Derby before joining BBC Sport Radio at Broadcasting House in London. It was a trip with his dad to the 1964 FA Cup final between Preston and West Ham, which was a life-changing moment for Mike, showing him the power of communication through commentary and how sports commentary could change people's lives. While at Wembley watching that FA Cup final, Mike noticed a Lancashire man looking up to the sky with a big smile on his face and enjoying the match through description and commentary from his sighted friend. During his life as a sports broadcaster, Mike received many letters from blind and partially sighted listeners. From his time working at BBC Radio Derby, right through to a note when he retired from the BBC in 2014 from the Right Honourable David Blunkett, thanking him for bringing football to life for him over the years. In this extended version of my interview via Zoom with Mike, we chatted about his early life supporting his local football club, Plymouth Argyle, his time at both BBC Radio Derby and at BBC Sport in Broadcasting House, what it was like working with some of the great sports broadcasters, of course not forgetting that life-changing moment at the FA Cup final in 1964, and Mike's thoughts on the state of sports broadcasting and management of the England football team over his career. I first began by asking Mike why he wanted to write After Extra Time and Penalties and why it was so important for him to record an audio book version.
Well, I wanted to write the book for a couple of reasons, really, Toby. Having been a football correspondent for nearly a quarter of a century and lived through so many changes in my sport, football, and also in broadcasting as well, I just felt I wanted to document all of that. I mean, I particularly wanted to write something for my children to pass on as well through the family. And the other really important thing I wanted to do was to pay tribute in the book to some of the radio sport pioneers who were my mentors, who just helped me enormously. And I'm talking about great commentators like Peter Jones and Brian Butler, because there's never really been that much written about them. And I thought, well, I was lucky enough to work with these people, and I just felt obliged to do it, wanted to do it. And in terms of the audiobook, well, I think that's almost kind of self-explanatory, really, because I was deeply aware during my time as a broadcaster that many of the people who were listening to me relied on me because they weren't able to see. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do a book, then it's just logical for them to be able to hear that book as well and hear my voice.
And you say in the book, from the age of seven, you always had an ambition to want to work at the BBC. Was that always in the back of your mind whilst you were going through school and university that you were desperate to get into the BBC and work there?
That's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure exactly the moment when I thought this is going to be the career and the pathway I want to pursue. I think in my early days as a seven-year-old, it was just more about my obsession with radio, I think. I was brainwashed by radio, really, as a child. And the reason for that was that it was always on in the home. I was born in 1950, and radio had really come into its own during the Second World War. Everybody had relied on it in the way that I think people have again over these last three or four difficult months. The only fantasy, really, that our black and white little television, we only had one channel on the television in those days. The only thing that could offer me, really, was cowboys and Indians films, you know. So that my senses were much more stirred by listening to music, listening to sport on the radio. I mean, for example, I can remember freezing January mornings when we lived in Wales, getting up and seeing my dad listening to the cricket commentary crackling through from Australia, you know, and I was sort of mesmerised by that. And I remember listening to all the children's favourites, the records, the Danny Kaye stuff, the Max Bygraves and everything else. And then a decade later, When I had my own little transistor, I'd take it off to bed with me and listen to Radio Luxembourg, and I loved hearing all the football commentaries coming from overseas. And even I was so obsessive that I used to even listen to the Test cricket on the radio and keep the score. You know, I used to keep the score listening to the Test cricket on the radio. And even now, I've only got to hear a piece of music, like say the Pick of the Pops theme or something like that, or the Hancock's half hour music, to remind me of my radio days as a youngster. So I was completely indoctrinated by radio.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people, I mean, I certainly grew up listening to radio like you did, and listening to radio underneath my bedclothes in bed, and memories of family trips in the car listening to Test Match Special as well. And it was a warmth, and it was something which was really there in the background. I
Do you know
mean,
what's really interesting was that because I mentioned listening to all these football commentaries coming in from Eastern Europe, you hardly hear some of it. It was so the lines were always so poor, but it sounded like it was coming, you know, from Czechoslovakia and everything. And it really appealed to your senses. Later in life, when I became a commentator, and the lines coming in from all over the world were pristine, you know, it didn't sound like you were commentating from China or somewhere. And in fact, there was a couple of occasions when the lines went down, and we had to use the phone. And we had hundreds of people writing in saying, "Oh, let's go back to these days. This sounds great, you know."
it's like it's like the old sort of long wave radio in the car, isn't it? It's that sort of
Yes, yeah.
bit different to now. I mean, but back then, did you think that you would ever get there? And did you think that those ambitions that you had as a child would ever be fulfilled? Sort of looking back now.
We have to be very lucky, and I was very lucky. I was the beneficiary of sort of sliding doors experiences, and I know I was fortunate in many ways to get the breaks that I got, because when I started off in local radio, which was my foundation in Derby, they were wonderful years. I'd only had a couple of years of experience commentating for the Birmingham Hospital Radio Network when I was a student in Birmingham. I helped them out with some football and cricket commentary. It was awful. I mean, I would hate to hear that stuff now, you know, but at least it gave me something to knock on the door at Radio Derby with. And 'cause I'd been rejected by quite a few radio stations up until that day. So I knew I was being fortunate when they invited me in. And it just so happened that on that day, they'd heard that one of their staff was going on an attachment for 3 months, so they had a vacancy. So they asked me if I'd like to start, and I did. And I mean, I did crucial jobs in the early days, like reclaiming the tape, you know, so it could be used again for interviews and things like that. And it took me a couple of years before I was actually given a microphone and then started broadcasting.
Going back to the first match you ever went to with your dad, I think it was Plymouth Argyle at Home Park. Can you remember that experience of being there with your dad at first time and that sort of father-son experience?
Well, it was one of the happiest days of my life. It was one of those days that you never really want to end, because I'd had this sort of slow build-up to going to see Plymouth Argyle. I used to play for the Wolf Club Cubs in the park outside where the ground was. So when we were playing our games on a Saturday afternoon, if Argyle were at home, I could hear the crowd, and there was usually about 25,000 people in the ground. So again, that sort of got my senses working overtime. And I'd been told about some of the players at school, because two of my school colleagues used to go to the matches. And so when I finally did go with him, it was an FA Cup game against Gillingham. It just, everything about it was just, I mean, looking at it as a child, the whole experience, it seemed to me in those days, was just so much more theatrical than it is now anyway, because you didn't see the teams until they ran out at 5 to 3. They weren't on the pitch warming up or anything like that. You had a brass band playing before the game, and stood behind the goal. I had a little stool to stand on because I wasn't very tall. And there were no away fans either, because these were days before motorways. So, you know, there was no way that you were ever going to see anybody from another club at Home Park. And they were not a great side, but they gave me my foundation. And what's been wonderful for me now is that since retirement, I'm back in that area again. And I've been able to take my second son to see Argyle play, because I never had the chance to do that with my oldest boy, you know, because of my BBC commitments.
And great memories for both of you to cherish, I suspect, as well. And did you still get that sort of excitement and experience of your first match when you were going to games that you were reporting on, or was it a different experience?
Well, first of all, I think your relationship with footballers changes when you start working in the business. You become less starry-eyed. I mean, I was a Plymouth Argyle fan and then a Derby County fan when we moved. and couldn't support Plymouth anymore because we're just too far away. And so I used to idolise those players. But when I started to watch games and I was interviewing players, clearly the relationship changes, which is sad in a way in that I did lose that. I suppose inevitably some of the games become routine, but the ones that always give you a tingle, you can never be ever complacent about going to see any England game, for example, especially in a World Cup or a European Championship. Always used to get a little tingle when the anthems were played before that game. All the big Champions League nights as well, they're nights that I really miss now. And FA Cup finals. FA Cup finals were always very special. In fact, I owe the FA Cup final everything, really, in terms of teaching me about the power of radio, about the power of communication, because my eyes were completely open the day my dad took me to see the West Ham-Preston game in 1964 at Wembley. And, for me, that was my kind of road to Damascus day. And you probably know that story, do you?
Yeah, I do. This the story of you going with your dad to the 1964 FA Cup final and listening to a Lancashire man commentating on the match to his blind friend. And you say in the book he was sort of a smile on his face. He was looking up to the sky and really enjoying the match through the commentary from his friend. That's a real sort of standout moment for me in your book. And I wondered, as you say, sort of it affected your career in a way and gave you an experience that you may not have come across before. And how much of a changing experience was that particular moment? Because there are other changing moments in the book, but that one seems to stand out.
Well, it just demonstrated to me, really, the role of the commentator in the most amateur way, really, between these two lads, because the one that couldn't see, and he was just looking up at the sky, and he had his Preston shirt on, and he had his big rosette and everything else, and had a lovely smile on his face, because I don't know what relation he was. He might have been his brother, he might just have been a friend, but he was describing the whole game to him. And it took me a few minutes to really work out what was going on. And then when I did realise, I was just mesmerised, really. I almost sort of started to listen to his commentary myself, you know. And I think for me, the golden rule of radio was that you're only really or should be commentating or communicating with one person, one listener. And I think if you believe the opposite to that, then you're kind of losing the plot, really, if you think you're talking to thousands, because it'll sound like that. And I probably had two people in mind when I was commentating. I used to think about my next door neighbour when I was growing up, who became a sort of inherited uncle, and he encouraged me to follow my dreams. And he was interested in football without being completely obsessed with it. So in that way, I hoped, if I was thinking of him, I was pitching it at the right level. But then I also never forgot that moment at Wembley and that realisation that somebody was relying on those words to be able to enjoy the game. And in fact, when I did retire, and I received a lot of nice messages when I retired, probably the one that meant the most to me was a thank you from David Blunkett, the former Home Secretary, because obviously he's a blind listener. He's a passionate Sheffield fan. You know, we must have brought him many moments of highs and lows. So in the back of my mind, I always try to think of my next door neighbour. And I always used to try and think of somebody who actually couldn't see the game. So they were needing our commentary even more.
And there are some great descriptive moments in the book when you, I think, describe one of the football pitches as a sort of a sticky toffee pudding kind of pitch and talking about Lowry sort of type skylines and stadiums and things like that. Was there always time to add in those descriptive moments compared to sort of commentating on what was happening on the pitch? Were you able to sort of give that full picture?
You had to, even amidst the hurly-burly of the game, try and make time for that light and shade. I think it's so important. I think, actually, football commentary is quite a simple procedure, really. I mean, some people do try and overcomplicate it, but obviously there's a world of difference, as everyone will appreciate, between a football commentary on the radio and on the television. And on the radio, you've got to try and make the listener feel that they're sitting next to you, ideally, at the venue, by, as you've just talked about, painting as many pictures as you can. My mentor, really, in football commentary, and your older listeners will remember Peter Jones. He was a master craftsman at this. If you ever listen to any of his commentaries, for the first 2 or 3 minutes, he would set the scene for you vividly, always in colour. He would describe the stadium, the weather, the fans, his vantage point. And then when the game started, he didn't try and describe everything that was happening in the game, because that's very difficult. It just sounds a bit of a jumble if you try and do that. So he let the game breathe. He took an overview like they do in the tennis, and he adhered to the two golden rules. And I think this is really important, Toby. The golden rules for me in radio commentary first of all, is you've got to tell the listener where the ball is, and you've got to give the score. It sounds so simple, but you would be amazed how many people actually don't. So if you listen and you don't know where the ball is, then obviously you can't really follow the game. No. And the simple way of doing that, if I'll use an example, I mean, if Manchester United are playing in front of you, say, from left to right, and their right back is Gary Neville, if he's got the ball, you know, you say the ball is now with Gary Neville, near side the right. I mean, that's absolutely crucial. It's not rocket science. And as a listener, myself now, I get infuriated if I don't know where the ball is and don't know what the score is. So geography, as well as painting those pictures you talked about, is the most important feature of any commentary. And then I think it's important also, thinking of the listener, to try and use your voice like a bit of a gearbox and not stay, you know, in one monotone level. You've got to try and move up the gears when it becomes more exciting. But then you mustn't make every game sound like the World Cup final, because then when you do finally get to the World Cup final, you've got nowhere to go. Also, a little bee in my bonnet now, as I listen to commentaries all the time, I suppose, is that I don't like commentaries being cluttered up with lots of meaningless facts and figures. I think you're there to describe the game.
From the book, I think, I may be overdoing this, but maybe that sort of sense of describing pictures may have come from you listening to the television through the floorboards of your family home and putting pictures to sound. I think we all did that as a kid.
Yeah, and that, of course, gets your imagination working overtime again, doesn't it? If you can't see those pictures. I mean, I used to be banned from watching. Oh, there was a program called Quatermass and the Pit. It was on at a, you know, this, I'm talking about early 60s now. And my mum and dad used to send me off to bed as soon as that came on, you know, because they thought it was far too scary. And so I used to listen to it through the floorboards and hear all these groans and everything else and screaming and think it was really horrendous. Actually, I did see it a few years ago, and it's like sooty and sweet, you know. I mean, it's but because I was denied that vision, and because I was listening and imagining that I was conjuring up all these sorts of horrible images, which actually weren't there at all. But it's great. And the lovely thing about sport, I think, is that I can only really talk about football, obviously, but I think nearly all sport works well on the radio. I think there are some that are more difficult than others. I could never really work out. There was a radio racing commentator called Peter Bromley, who, again, older listeners will remember. I could never work out how he's able to identify all of the horses, you know, in a Grand National, say, from distance. I thought that was wonderful. And I think tennis is probably the hardest sport to describe on the radio because of its speed. But the only sport that I tried foolishly to describe when I was in local radio, which was a total embarrassment and not really conducive to radio at all. I wonder if you can guess what it was. It was darts.
Okay.
And this was in the 1970s, before they had these electronic scoreboards to work it all out. You know, you had to try and do the maths in your head as the guy, so that when the competitor was throwing the dart, I was still with my very feeble mass trying to work out what he needed to win, when suddenly it was all over, you know, the crowd were cheering. And I was still trying to say, yeah, well, now he needs a, you know, treble six and the bang, you know. So that was an eye-opener. But no, but I mean, I just think radio and sport were made for each other.
And in those days that BBC Radio Derby, most local radio stations have a lot of loyal listeners who, you know, do support their local radio station. And I think you had then also lots of letters from visually impaired listeners sort of giving you possibly feedback and comments on your reporting and commentating. Can you remember any of those letters that they sent you?
Yes, I do. I can. And the letters I remember most of all from that time were, well, two lots of different kinds of letters, very different. I used to treasure the letters three, actually. I used to treasure the letters I got from the forces overseas in, you know, in terrible conflict situations, you know, who used to listen to the radio. I was very moved by getting letters from people in prison as well, who used to rely on the radio, and the visually impaired audience as well. They had a special program at Radio Derby, actually, which was a duplicated with Radio Nottingham. And I used to get lovely letters, which just made it all worthwhile, you know, to receive those. And it kind of kept my feet on the ground too.
And when you did make that move to BBC Radio Sport in Broadcasting House in London, and working with some of those great broadcasters that you mentioned earlier on, you know, Cliff Morgan, Brian Butler, Peter Jones, etc., etc., what was it like taking your first steps into Broadcasting House?
The first day at school, really. Yeah, no, really, because it was such a culture shock going from, where I used to live in Derby, which is just a couple of sort of traffic lights away from the radio station, and obviously it was one just big intimate happy family there. And then the commute to London every day was difficult to get used to. But then when you arrived at Broadcasting House, and I walked in on that first morning, the first Monday morning, and everyone seemed to have pre-assigned desks, two rows, and I'm looking at, Desmond Lynham, Christopher Martin Jenkins, Gerald Williams, Peter Jones. They were all there on that Monday morning, sort of eyeing me up and down, but then things evolve, and I ended up very fortunately having relationships with all of these people, like the ones I had at Radio Derby. Again, we were one big happy family in Broadcasting House. And Brian Butler, who was my predecessor as the football correspondent, he was, I've mentioned Peter, but what Brian, again, older listeners will remember, and this is an example of things that are better on radio, I think, than on television. Brian used to orchestrate and present the FA Cup draw from Lancaster Gate in London, the FA headquarters. And he presided over this, and it became a real institution. It was the way that he did it. It was very theatrical as he set the scene. And in fact, some people used to say that when he did it, you could almost smell the cigar smoke and the dust from the volumes of books, around him at Lancaster Gate seeping through the wireless. It was wonderful. And, he was just a master craftsman, was Brian, and I learned so much from him. And I just think that there are certain things. I watch the draw now on the television, and it's a real dog's dinner sometimes. And some things are best left to radio. I actually also think, I don't know if you'll agree with me or not, but I think it's better listening to football results on the radio than it is. Because if you don't know the score and you're listening for that inflection at the end to see whether your team have won or lost or drawn, there's nothing beats that for drama if you don't already know the score. Yeah, although television has in many ways sort of killed the radio star, and there are certain things still, I think, that radio is still on its own at doing.
And I think sport always sounds and looks better on radio. I remember, sort of at school and stuff, watching football matches or the tennis or even the cricket, and we would have a telly on for those who could see it better than others, and would have the sound down and the radio on in the background, because the radio just gave a better picture. To me, anyway.
Well, I know that there are some people even now who utilize the red button when there's a game on the television so that they can hear the sound commentary, because I suppose there's a bit more detail in that. I mean, one of the things that I always think that really you should feel you're there at the venue, and I didn't like it in many ways on television. I know it's superior technically, but I don't know if you remember, they started when you used to watch cricket in the old days, you just mentioned the cricket. They had a few cameras in the ground, and you had a camera behind the bowler. But then when it was the next over, the bowler was coming at it from the other side. It didn't move. Now you see it from behind the bowler's arm all the time, which is superior coverage, but it's not actually placing you in the arena, I don't think. And there's, about six of one and a half a dozen of the other. But television's coverage nowadays is wonderful. Some of the analysis as well is great, but there's nothing still quite like listening to Test Match Special on the radio. I think in many ways like to hear that and have the pictures as well.
I suppose the relationship between football and the media and radio has changed so much over the years. And, football has changed so much. I think in the book you say that after the 1966 World Cup, after England winning, which, hopefully England might win again someday, but football changed at that time. And I don't know whether you feel we can get back to those days where there is a closer link between the player and the fan and the team and the fan as well.
I suppose a lot depends on at what level you're watching the game. I think if you're asking me whether it will change in the Premier League, sadly it won't, I'm afraid. It just won't. But it can, there's still a chance lower down the leagues. When I first started watching, I used to go watching Derby County in Derby. We used to go sometimes, my dad and I, to the railway station, because the visiting team would come in on the train. And we'd walk to the ground with the players. We would literally walk to the baseball ground for half an hour from the railway station. And I can remember walking with some absolute giants of the game, Stanley Matthews, John Charles, people like that, to the game. And they weren't bothered too much by autograph hunters or anything like that. They took it all in their stride. But I suppose one of the biggest changes now is that relationship between the supporter and the fans. And I don't like the idea of having these exclusive tunnel clubs now in the Premier League where you can get access to players, but only if you spend thousands and thousands of pounds to get that. I think that is sad. I mean, I used to, when I was a kid, I used to write to players for autographs, and 99% of them would reply back. And I hope that still happens nowadays. I hope it does. Again, though, another sign of the times, Toby, when you do get the autograph, but you can't read it now. If you see a player's autograph nowadays, it's just a squiggle. It's almost like, I'm too busy. Do this as quickly as possible. You know, whereas if you look at the autographs of people like Jimmy Armfield or Bobby Charlton or Bobby Moore or Tom Finney, they're all pristinely written, you know. And also, they didn't, by the way, put their number of their shirt next to the name. They haven't got the audacity to do that. You know, they never assume that they own that shirt.
When you were commenting on football matches, I think you never used to use a monitor. You never had a TV monitor in front of you where you could see the game. You're always watching the game as you know, another fan would. Do you think your style of commentary would have changed if you started using a monitor, and would the experience have changed for the listener?
Well, I was a radio commentator. I was never done a television commentary in my life. I would have been quite interested to find out whether I could have done it. I would have done it obviously in a different way, but I never commentated for television. So in the end, that kind of proved to be not my undoing. That's too strong a word. But I realised, I think, at the Euro 2012 final in Ukraine, that probably my time was coming to an end because I made a mistake. I wrongly identified one of the goal scorers. Now, you know, in my defence, this goal was scored a heck of a long way away from where I was sitting. And there was a monitor, which if I'd used it, I would have known straight away that I'd made a mistake. But I wasn't accustomed to using the monitor. I was just accustomed only to using my vision, my eyes, and, you know, my instinct, if you like, I suppose. But I realised, I'm 62, that my eyesight wasn't as reliable as it had been. And I did commit myself too soon. And I just knew that in such an important game like that, when you're also commentating for the archive as well, you just can't make mistakes like that. So I suppose it was nature's way of telling me that you've had a good innings, son, time to stand down now. And I did. I just did the World Cup in 2014. And fortunately, that goal was easy to identify that I got in the final. Yeah, no, it's an interesting question that, because obviously if I had used the monitor, I would have known straight away who the goal scorer was. But I felt that's not my role here. I'm not commentating. You know, I've got to go with what I can see in front of me. And that was what I used to do.
And I think you finally hung up your BBC commentator's microphone in 2016. How hard was it for you walking away from BBC Sport and broadcasting? Well, it's a broadcasting house, but it probably wasn't broadcasting house, and it was probably Salford or somewhere.
It was a gradual exit because I did my last commentary in 2014. And then they asked me for 2 years to do one or two special programmes. So that was interesting because I went back to my roots, if you like, because I'd started off before commentating as a presenter of Sport On 2. So I was interested to do that. I did half a dozen programmes for them in the end and finished in 2016. And as you say, the last programme that I ever introduced and was involved in for the BBC was the celebration of 1966, 50 years on. And the lovely thing about that programme was that one of the guests was Jimmy Armfield, who was a member of that England World Cup squad, who'd become a great friend of mine, great colleague, sadly passed away. And so that was the last time we worked together. In fact, it's probably the last time we even spoke to each other. And the lovely thing about Jimmy Armfield, and it really says everything that I admire about football and the way it was then and possibly isn't now. I don't know if you remember, but Jimmy was in the World Cup squad, but only the 11 players got medals on that day who won the World Cup. And Jimmy had been a former England captain, and he was still one of the first people on the pitch at the end, on the final whistle, beaming and hugging everybody, even though he knew he wasn't going to be going up to the Royal Box to get a medal. What was important to him was England and the overall, you know, the team ethic, and that was just wonderful. And said an awful lot about him as a person.
Yeah, which you probably wouldn't get nowadays with with football players, sadly. Radio has changed a lot over the years, and possibly if some of those greats that we've talked about were listening to sports radio now, they might be turning in their graves. Where do you think people can go to still listen to great football commentary? Is it the local radio that still holds the bastion for a great football commentator?
Oh, there are still great commentators out there. Obviously, if you listen to local radio, they're looking at it slightly one-dimensionally because I can always remember making a mistake a few times when I was at Derby, Radio Derby, and because we couldn't afford to send reporters to all the games, the away games, we once got somebody to do a Bristol City match for us who was a Bristolian, you know. But this was for Radio Derby, so after about 10 minutes he came on and said, "Great news here, Bristol City have taken the lead," and I had to say to him, hey, you know, remember, this is Radio Derby, and they're not exactly dancing in the streets of Derby now to hear that news. So he realised, you know. So yeah, in local radio, obviously looking after their local people, but on the national level, although I still think there should be two commentators for a game and not one, I think the standard is as good as ever. I think, you know, the legacy of people like Peter Jones and Brian Butler is still in very good hands with commentators like John Murray and Ian Dennis. I'm really proud of the jobs they do, and they have to do a lot more than I ever had to do, because, you know, when I first started out, it was usually maybe one, two commentaries a week. Now, and particularly over this next month, there are going to be games almost every day of the week.
And Five Live is still, you know, sort of, it's a sports channel in a way, and you've got all those extra digital channels where you can listen to different games, which is fantastic that it is out there and it's still there.
Yeah, the one thing that they've got to be careful of, I think, they have to decide, they're at this crossroads, really, particularly Five Live. They've got this pursuit now of the younger audience. This is the thing. This is their big obsession now, to make sure that they can nurture relationships with the younger generation now. But of course, and that is absolutely vital, because if the younger people later in life don't listen to the radio, then there'll be no more radio. So I understand all of that. It's just the way they're going about it. Somebody has decided somewhere that the only way to attract the younger audience is to have young people talking to them. And to me, that's not necessarily the case, because when I was growing up listening to those voices on the radio in the 50s, I didn't care how old the people were. I was just loved the authority and the sound of the voice, and loved some of the regional accents. The other thing, of course, now is if you have this kind of revolutionary change and you just have young people on all the time, then you're going to possibly alienate the loyal audience you've already got. So it's a big balancing act they've got to try and pull off here. And at the moment, I just think they're not quite along the right lines.
Yeah, because as I said earlier, you know, as a young boy, I was listening to sort of Brian Johnson on Test Match Special, and I do remember, although I didn't listen that hard to, but I do remember Sport on 2 and the theme music, and you know, and you listen to, you know, any voice, you know, it doesn't matter how old the person is.
No. I mean, I used to listen to a wonderful broadcaster called Alistair Cook, who used to...
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Yes. Now, he used to do this Letter from America, which was just legendary. Now, a lot of the time, what he was saying was, I was quite young and I didn't quite understand all the politics and everything else, but I was just completely entranced by his voice and his authority and the way that he could, it was amazing to think that he could sort of write those words for radio onto a page and then make it sound like he was not reading it. He was just wonderful. But equally, you know, I used to love listening to John Peel on Radio One, a totally different style. So, and in the end, if you'd asked me in the 60s, so how old is John Peel? I wouldn't have a clue how old John Peel was. You know, it didn't matter. He just connected with me. Again, he had this wonderful ability to talk to you as if he was just talking to you, which I mentioned earlier. I just think that's really crucial.
As a young boy, you at school, you played football, you know, sort of in the park, and I think you played cricket as well. Would you have ever considered trying to make a career as a player on the pitch rather than reporting on it?
I would have considered it, but nobody would have considered me. I wasn't very good, honestly, Toby. I mean, this is probably one of the reasons why I thought, well, if I can't play, I might as well go and talk about it. I could always talk a good game. That was the thing, you know. I was always, in my head, I was a lot better than I really was, you know. I was a bit of a clogger as a footballer. But I loved it. I mean, I loved the thing that really gets to me now a little bit, because neither of my boys had the opportunity to play cricket very much. And I was a teenager, we used to be playing three games every weekend, cricket for local teams and for school teams and everything else. In fact, what the local team I played for in Derbyshire, in Belper, I remember playing with Brian Clough once. You know, he played for us.
Wow.
But the thing about the cricket was much more than sort of harbouring ambition of being a cricketer. It was the social scene. It was just wonderful social scene, you know. And in fact, when I was at Radio Derby, we used to have a cricket team every Wednesday night. We used to go around the county playing people as well. So those were just great days. But no, I was never gonna never ever going to make it as a, in fact, that's what's really resonated with me, I think. The fact that, you know, when you're at school and you see these people who you think are going to be superstars, you think they're all going to be Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi. And then, of course, what happens is they just appear off the face of the earth. You know, they don't become footballers. And you think, well, how high must it be at the very top level when people who you consider in your youth to be really talented, you know, don't even register anywhere? It just makes you realise how competitive it is.
And how hard it is to get through. I remember, you know, friends at school who are good at athletics and were quite high up and winning, you know, sort of, you know, lots of medals and things at local sports and, you know, inter county championships and stuff and things like that. And you think, I wonder if they continued their career as an athlete.
Yes, but, yes. I mean, there probably are some people out there that might have been able to make it had they had the breaks and if they hadn't been forced into. I mean, sometimes, you know, in my days in the 60s, parents used to just make their kids leave school and get jobs. You know, they had never had a chance to do any kind of apprenticeship like that. So there probably have been a few people who've been. And the very fact that, you know, we can all think of examples of players who very late in the day came through, like Ian Wright's a classic example, for example. You know, he came through the system quite late and then became a really great player. So I'm sure there have been a few who've been lost by the wayside. But no, I mean, going back to your question, though, I might have made a good manager because I could have told everybody how to do it. But no, I was never ever going to seriously threaten Dave Mackay in the Derby County team or anything like that, I don't think.
Yeah, you mentioned being a manager, and I wonder from reading the book, because you talk a lot about, you know, sort of different management styles and how things perhaps could have been managed better. But I suppose it's difficult when you're inside the football sort of, I suppose, not necessarily clique, but you're with you're there as a reporter, you're part of the bunch in a way. And you can see things from the inside, and you can think, like a lot of people in life, you can think, oh, I know, I could do that better, but it's actually making that change. Do you think you could have got a better England team and as a manager?
Well, could I got a better England team? Well, I probably wouldn't have picked any different players. I just feel that the great sadness of my time watching England, my regret really, was the fact that I started in 1990 commentating on England at the World Cup when they probably peaked too soon, really, and played wonderfully well in the semi-final against Germany, only to lose on penalties, which is, what again, why I call the book After Extra Time and Penalties. And then I thought it was always going to be like that. But of course, what really used to get me was the fact that you used to see these players, and you wouldn't probably have disagreed with too many of the selections, week in and week out, doing their stuff for their clubs and really looking great players. And then suddenly, when they put the white shirt on of England, they just seemed to freeze. They just didn't seem to have the mentality to be able to deal with it. And I suppose a lot of that comes down to the management. I work with maybe a dozen England managers. And the only one that really ticked all the boxes in terms of getting absolutely everything right, the tactics, the selection of players, making sure the players' minds were right, was Terry Venables at Euro 96. All of the others, Glenn Hoddle did a good job too, but the experiment of going overseas with Sven-Göran Eriksson and Fabio Capello at a time when they really did have a good crop of players just didn't work for a variety of reasons, really. Eriksson, but they were both great people to work with. I really enjoyed working with them, but in a funny sort of way, although they were bringing in the mystique of an overseas coach, Sven-Göran Eriksson was more English than anyone because he just stuck to the same old rigid tactics, 4-4-2. And then when Fabio Capello came in, he just didn't, I'm afraid, really grasp the mentality and the culture of the English footballer. And you know, he locked them all away in the way that Italians might be quite happy to read a book and everything else when they're at a World Cup, but the England players just weren't like that, and he never really understood that. So that was my one regret, the fact that in all my time, I never really saw the England players, apart from Euro 96, do themselves just, and that was when Venables was coach, of course. Apart from Euro 96, they didn't really do justice to themselves. That was the thing. They didn't play the way that, you know, that night when they beat Holland 4-1, that was the night when that was what I'd always wanted to see from an England team, and we did that night.
I suppose, you know, in our lifetime, we may not see England win the World Cup again. I mean, it'd be great if they could, but
apart from the frustration of never seeing England, hardly ever seeing England do themselves justice in big tournaments, I also got, in the end, quite frustrated by their failure to deal with penalties, because penalties became such a big factor in games. I saw them lose so many penalty shootouts, again, why I call the book After Extra Time Penalties. I only saw them win one, and that was in the the quarterfinal of Euro 96. And what I couldn't quite get my head around was the fact that they went off to all these tournaments superbly prepared. They always had the best facilities and everything else. You wouldn't have really disagreed with the makeup of the squad. And yet they couldn't get to grips with penalties, whereas other countries learn from their mistakes. I remember Italy losing the World Cup semi-final in Italy and the World Cup final in America on penalties, but then going away, doing a bit of work on it, and then coming back and winning a World Cup on penalties. And England never got, they always used to say, oh, well, you know, you can't practice penalties, it's not the same, but they could have made more effort. And of course, the irony was, Toby, that they waited for me to retire. And then the very next World Cup in Russia, they went and beat Colombia on penalties. I think that's a huge psychological breakthrough. But whether England will win another World Cup in our lifetime it's the lap of the gods, really, because you can't legislate for injuries, you can't legislate for the draw you get in the tournament and everything else. But probably at the moment, they've got one of the best chances they've had for a long time, I think, in terms of having Gareth Southgate, who I think, I mentioned Terry Venables ticking all the boxes. I think Southgate does too now. I'm sorry I didn't get the chance to work with him. I worked with him when he was a player. And the interesting thing about Southgate is he was very much tutored by Terry Venables and has taken a lot of Venables' ideas on board with him. So, you know, I think they do have a good chance, but there are a lot of other good teams out there. I mean, you can see some of these young German players coming through again now. So it's a tough one, especially at the end of a long, hard Premier League season.
I think we might have to wait for the women's game to actually get the World Cup for men.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, I love some of the women's football, which we saw last year was fantastic. I really got into that. Yeah. And to be honest, I got to the point watching it where I wasn't even aware that they were winning. You know, I was just looking at it as a great game of football, and some of the skills were remarkable.
It's great to see women's football being supported on television and radio and for other sports as well. When you think of, you know, looking back to the Olympics, the 2012 Olympics and Paralympics, you know, it was a great time for showcasing disabled sport, and the coverage of disabled sport has sort of grown every time during the Paralympics. And, you know, I think that was a turning point for disabled sport. And it's great to see both VI football and you know, disabled football as well, Paralympic football as well. It's, you know, I think it's fantastic to see those matches and for people to experience what disabled sport is like. And maybe there's a sort of closer link between the players and the fans, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's less cynical for a start than the football at the sharp end of the Premier League. And the thing is that BBC television have been criticised a lot in recent times for losing so many of the major sports that you took for granted being on BBC television. You know, the things that you just assumed were going to be there, like, you know, the test cricket and stuff like that, and the horse racing. But the one thing they have managed to do is to follow on from what you've just said. They really have given some of the disabled sport a platform, and particularly when it comes to things like the Paralympics. I think the coverage there has been very, very good.
Well, Mike, thank you so much indeed for your time today and for chatting with me. It's been fantastic. And
well, thank you, Toby. Thank you.
And the book is absolutely wonderful. It was a great listen. I enjoyed listening to the whole book, and you know, some fabulous moments in there. But thank good. You so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for taking an interest in it. Thank you.
After extra time and penalties, Memories of a BBC Football Correspondent by Mike Ingham is published by Book Guild Publishing and is available as an audiobook, a Kindle download, and in other formats. To find out more about my portfolio of services, do visit my website, tobydavy.co.uk, where you will also find out how to contact me and follow me on social media. Do all keep safe and well.